Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
If your food media diet is fueled by HRN, become a monthly donor today. Visit heritageradionetwork.org/donate.
Alrighty then, this is What Doesn't Kill You Food Industry Insights. I'm your host, Katie Kiefer, and with me on the phone today is Mike Calicrate, an independent cattle producer, business entrepreneur, and political activist. He serves as an outspoken leader in addressing the rural, social, and cultural impacts of current economic trends. Mike was a founding member of several farm advocacy groups, including the Organization for Competitive Markets, RCAF USA, and the Kansas Cattlemen's Association. He also was a lead plaintiff in a class action lawsuit against the world's largest meat packer, IBP, now part of Tyson Foods, alleging unfair and discriminatory marketing practices. And that lawsuit, Mike, sprang from violations of what you felt were the Packers and Stockyards Act. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's right, Katie.
So thank you. First of all, thank you so much for joining me on the show today. You have been a guest a few times. So people, if you want to go back and listen to, I looked at my archives and Mike was on about a year ago. Before the Biden presidency began and before the executive order of July 8th was issued from the president's office, which is what we're going to be talking about today. And that executive order runs across many, many industries in the United States, and it addresses multiple issues, both for all industries in terms of consolidation and monopolization, which, you know, people who regularly listen to this show know that's been a hobby horse for me for about 8 years. But also, it has a huge section on the animal agriculture industry, which I thought was really, really extraordinary, because we really have not seen any administration since I started doing this show over 10 years ago that has directly addressed animal agriculture. So this I thought was groundbreaking. So to start us off, the executive order includes a section that charges the Secretary of Agriculture, Tom Vilsack, with, quote, consider issuing new rules under the Packers and Stockyards Act, making it easier for farmers to bring and win claims. And I'm going to go on. I'm sorry about all the quotes here, but it's important to get the language. To wit, quote again, in such rulemaking or rulemakings, the Secretary of Agriculture shall consider, among other things, reinforcing the longstanding Department of Agriculture interpretation that it is unnecessary under the Packers and Stockyards Act to demonstrate industry-wide harm to establish a violation of the act, and that the unfair, unjustly discriminatory, or deceptive treatment of one farmer, the giving to one farmer of an undue or unreasonable preference or advantage, or the subjection of one farmer to an undue or unreasonable prejudice or disadvantage in any respect, violates the act. So this is what you have been driving towards since the 90s, right, Mike?
That's right, Katie. When we filed the lawsuit against IBP in 1996, we were basically claiming under the Packers and Stockyards Act that they were being discriminatory and unjust in the treatment of certain cattle feeders and providing undue preference to other cattle feeders in order to get the captive supplies, in other words, that supply of animals, of cattle, that they needed for their plants without having to compete in the open and competitive market for them. And so they could either own them or they could in some manner control that inventory. Well, IBP decided to do the smartest thing of all, not own any animals ever, except for, you know, a week ahead of the slaughter or maybe 2 weeks at the most, and just let the feedlots take all the risk of ownership and the capital requirement of ownership, And in this brilliant thing called the formula, which I call the nuclear warhead in the arsenal of captive supplies, it's what they use to depress the cash market and to, you know, drive us out of business. And so wow. we were making a claim that with the formula that IBP had devised, which they didn't have to own any livestock or take any risk on any livestock. In fact, all they had to do was just give a feedlot market access in order to get those captive supplies. And I know they did give certain feedlots quite a lot of preference. But others were just happy to get hook space. They were just happy to get a place to, you know, sure. get those animals slaughtered close to when they were ready. And so, you know, we were fighting that. And of course, we'd seen this massive drop in the producer share of the consumer dollar and in drop in live cattle prices in general. And so, you know, the Packers and Stockyards Act was the tool to fix it.
Right.
And yet the problem is when the government won't even enforce their own laws, you go to a judge, especially a Reagan appointee type judge like Judge Strom, the one that we had in our case, Lyle E. Strom. He was a Reagan appointee. He not only didn't agree with the Packers and Stockyards Act in its clear language, but he basically, you know, reversed our win. We won in front of the jury, $1.28 billion in damages, wow. and the judge within days reversed that jury verdict and set an extremely bad precedent.
Right.
You know, basically, you know, all this, you know, we've got to prove harm to competition, the rule of reason. Look, the judge said, if Cargill and ConAgra or Cargill and JBS now, if they're using captive supplies, doesn't IBP have to as well to compete? You know, so basically, instead of making the market more competitive and fair, the judge set precedent giving these big meat packers, all the big meat packers, the green light to really take advantage of yeah. producers. And, yeah. and so what we're asking, you know, Vilsack to do and the president, Biden, to do now is, look, folks, we've set some really bad precedent when we did file lawsuits. Let's make it clear. Let's make it very clear to all law enforcement, including judges, that this is what we mean by the Packers and Stockyards Act. And let's get back to, you know, open, fair, and competitive markets.
Right, right. I mean, I want to just drill down on the one point here, which was, I think, the point that really sort of sunk your boat and has sunk so many others, which is that you have to prove, one farmer or one rancher has to prove not that he is being harmed, or he and his cohort and his, you know, colleagues, but that industry-wide, all ranchers are being impacted in the same way. And that created a precedent that was, I mean, you couldn't possibly, unless you literally got every single cattle rancher in the United States to agree, you couldn't possibly win a lawsuit without that, right?
That's right. And these big corporations, they've been so tricky. They've had so many ways to flout the law. Yeah. Or, and its enforcement. And that's just so in your face wrong. And it's like if you're a woman whose purse is stolen and so you know, some guy runs the thief down and he catches him and you know, you're worried about your purse and getting it back. And now you want to prosecute the guy for stealing it. And basically the court is going to tell you, well, if you can prove that every other woman in America that has a purse was harmed by the theft of your purse,
right,
then you've got a case. Otherwise, go home and be quiet.
Right.
And so when A.T. Terry caught Tyson cheating him on his poultry weights, he was a grower for Tyson, mm-hmm. this is the rule that knocked out his case. He couldn't wow. prove that every other poultry grower in America had been hurt by Tyson stealing his chickens.
Right.
And so, you know, here the guy is. He's filed a lawsuit against his integrator, the person or the company that supplies his chickens. And so now he's filing bankruptcy because he can't pay the mortgage on his buildings.
Right.
And I mean, you just feel how helpless that is. Is this America, yeah. really?
Yeah.
No,
it's not. That's
this
a shocking
is unfair.
Story.
This is corporate rule. And yeah. and when they get our courts and our legislatures and, you know, all of Congress, you know, somebody was just talking the other day about money, you know, for lobbying. And I was just describing to him how many congressmen you can buy for $10,000. I mean,
oh, yeah.
I mean, and they don't just see 10,000, they see millions coming at them. And so we've really got a lot of repairs to make here. And I love that Biden issued this executive order. I think we've got some really top-notch people in place to start improving some things in restoring some competition. But we cannot overlook the power of big corporations. I mean, did you happen to read the Wall Street Journal article that followed the executive order that said, boy, this is going to be in court. This will be in court for a long time. This is not something that's going to happen overnight. Well, darn right. That is true. They will. They will be in court. They will push back on breaking up monopoly power. But we've got to win. We just, and Katie, the only way we actually win in the end is if we get Congress back on the side of the citizens instead of the corporations.
Yeah.
Because Congress can always fix what the court messes up.
Yeah.
Through clarification, through new legislation if necessary.
Right,
But what's so frustrating for producers like myself is that we win oftentimes. We win with legislation.
Uh-huh.
You know, we win in the court only to have a judge reverse our jury verdict. Or if we win in Congress, like with country of origin labeling, which is going to get looked at again here.
Yes, we're going to talk about that.
Then they just write the rules to where it reverses the intent of Congress. Mm-hmm. You know, they did it with mandatory price reporting. We were so celebratory. I mean, we were so excited about getting mandatory price reporting years ago when we got country of origin labeling. But all we did was wake up the bear. We poked the bear being the meatpacking monopoly. They just simply came in and wrote the rules to incorporate confidentiality, which basically reversed the intent of Congress to have a transparent marketplace.
Right.
And so now we're back at the table after all this damage is done. Yeah. I mean, we've lost nearly half our cattle producers. We've lost 83,000 independent cattle feeders. You know, we've lost basically all our pig farmers.
Absolutely. Yep.
So, yeah, it's way too late, but it's better than never.
It's better than never. So just give us an idea of how you think this, I mean, assuming that the meatpacking industry does not litigate this to death and, you know, I mean, the Packers and Starkyards Act is already on the books. So they, you know, if it's enforced the way it's supposed to, you know, if it works the way it's supposed to, how will that change, you know, the lives of ranchers like you?
Well, it can change. It can certainly change our lives and change it pretty quick if we can get the Secretary of Agriculture, Tom Vilsack, to just step in and say, look, this is what the Act says. This is what the Act means. And we're going to start filing some lawsuits.
Well, wasn't he supposed to do that, though, during the Obama administration? And then they just totally dropped the ball. They just completely walked away from that. I mean, they had the obstructive Congress, fair enough. But really, you know, this was talked about 8 years ago and nothing happened. So I'm curious why you think Vilsack is suddenly going to come to his senses and do the right thing.
I was pretty disappointed in his appointment because of what you just described. His performance with Obama was pathetic.
Yeah.
And the thing we did back, you know, in 2010 is we had the hearings, the antitrust hearings. And that was pretty exciting. I mean, they were all over the country with Vilsack and the Justice Department. And I remember Phil Weiser, our Colorado Attorney General, was on that team to really look at how do we restore competition, maybe address some monopoly power, and it all went away. In fact, Lena Khan, who is now our lead chair of the Federal Trade Commission, which I'm really excited about.
Yeah, she should be
very
good.
She wrote the article, Obama's Game of Chicken, and that. What happened with Obama back in those days probably did as much damage to the Packers and Stockyards Act and the possibility of enforcement as anything ever did, because it did let the meat packers win. It let that monopoly just gave it all the energy it needed, a total green light to completely consolidate and concentrate and centrally plan part of our most valuable part of America's food system.
Yeah.
And so we've got a lot to make up for now under Biden. And it was interesting. I saw Phil Weiser at an event here in Colorado one day, and he came up to me and he says, "You know, Mike, I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry that we didn't get it done before." But, you know, Phil Weiser's in a position right now as a Colorado Attorney General. Mm-hmm. Why doesn't he just revoke JBS's corporate charter?
I don't know.
Why do they allow these criminal corporations, I mean serial criminal corporations, to continue to do business in our country? Phil could lead attorneys general across the country in basically taking away their corporate charters. And on the other hand, if USDA wants to get really, really aggressive here in addressing this corporate power and monopoly in our meatpacking, which one of these multinational meatpackers are not guilty of several felony counts of all kinds?
All those price-fixing things. Tyson paid, what, $27 million to settle out of court because they were the first ones to say, "Yeah, you're right, we did." And now we're gonna rat out the other guys.
That's exactly what happened. And look at the Batista brothers with JBS.
They're both in jail, right?
They're world champions. Yeah. I mean, they are record setters when it comes to breaking the law. And yet we allow them to expand around the globe. I mean, there should be a global movement to get these guys back in jail again forever. Yeah. I mean, they should never put a knife to a piece of meat ever.
Yeah.
And so, you know, we look at our food security and how that's related to national security. We're in big time trouble. And so, our state's attorneys generals could come together and say, "Look, we don't want these criminals operating, especially in such a critical industry as food. And let's go ahead and take them over, turn those big plants into public utilities, open up some of the ones they've already closed because they want 100% throughput, which means they have no resiliency when bad stuff happens."
Right.
Open up those other plants that they closed and let's start selling them off. And let's start regionalizing and localizing food systems with some great policy that supports that.
Yeah.
And eventually in 10 years, you know, these big plants will be mothballed, shut down. I don't know what you do with those silly things. There's no good use of those massive plants.
Right.
And I say, build the alternative and gradually shut those big massive plants down, turn them into public utilities right away so we can stop the price gouging and just all of the horrible things that happen in those big plants, from exploitation of workers to the animal welfare problems to all the anti-competitive practices, and just get these guys retired, hopefully with no money. They can go back and get some real jobs somewhere. Perhaps they can weed some fields back out in California under the hot sun.
That feels like for a change, right?
Let them work the blood pit maybe in some of these smaller plants.
But we just have to
do this. And it really does bother me that President Biden uses words like consider.
Yes.
You know,
we're going to talk about that. Yeah.
Yeah. I want to see a whole lot stronger language. But here's the problem. Biden doesn't have a Congress willing to work with him.
Right.
We can't even get all the Democrats on one side.
Right.
And I don't know which Republicans might jump over onto this idea of, you know, controlling monopolies. But until we get Congress to represent people again, you do have to use words like consider, because we don't have Congress's support to even control monopoly power in our own country.
Yeah, it is really interesting that those words, you know, considering issuing new rules is not the same as issuing the rules. You know, it's like, you know, I was quite dismayed when I read the language, because I just thought, you know, you can consider all you want, Jack, but, you know, until you actually follow through with enforcement and with antitrust legislation and with, you know, attorneys general going after these big, you know, whatever it takes. You know, I don't know. You know, this is very nice, you know, whitewashing of a huge problem. But I want to move on to another section, because, you know, we do have limited time here, not too limited, but limited enough. And that was the part which I understood to be about labeling. So I'm going to, in another section, the executive order dictates that this agricultural secretary et al., quote, quote, consider issuing new rules defining when meat can bear product of USA labels so that consumers have transparent labels that enable them to choose products made in the USA. Now the way it works is, say you're a JBS, if you bring, and correct me if I'm wrong, Mike, but you know, these companies can buy their cattle outside of the United States, bring it in, and if it's processed, cut up into steaks and chops and ground meat, then it can be labeled a product of the USA when it in fact is not such a thing. So
that is true.
They are talking about cool here, right? They're talking about country of origin labeling. I was very confused by that.
There are a couple of things. Right now, if we import beef from Mexico and just put it in a different box, It will qualify for product of the USA. That is clearly misleading. That is clearly deceptive.
Totally.
And all of us would probably, most everyone would agree, it's fraudulent labeling. Yet, and USDA has full control of this. Vilsack can decide tomorrow that will now stop. You cannot deceive the consumer in thinking something is from the USA with labeling that indicate it is when it isn't. That can get fixed tomorrow by the Secretary of Agriculture. Cool cannot get fixed by the Secretary of Agriculture tomorrow because it's a choice of Congress. When Congress came in and chickened out on the idea that we should be able to label our beef as born, raised, and processed in the USA, and that interfered with our trade agreement under the WTO.
That's right.
Canada and Mexico was complaining. Pat Roberts in the Senate, my senator from Kansas, you know, he led the repeal of Kuhl on the Senate side, trying to make his meatpacker friends happy.
Yep.
And John Boehner on the House side led the repeal of Kuhl on the House side, only later to retire and go to work from JBS for JBS on a board, a board position with JBS. So, you know, he got rewarded for his work. And JBS was the biggest beneficiary of repealing Kuhl.
Of course.
From the beef side, of course, Smithfield was the biggest beneficiary on the pork side.
Right.
And so Congress was totally manipulated and totally sold out the interests of citizens.
Well, the WTO, I mean, that lawsuit that was brought via the WTO by Canada and Mexico, and I'm sure other countries joined in as well, but they were threatening to fine the United States, you know, quite a substantial sum of money. I forget what it was, maybe $30 billion a year or something like that.
Yeah, it was like $4 billion, I think.
$4 billion. Anyways, it was a big chunk of change, but not bigger than the cattle industry.
Right. In fact, it might have been $1 billion, but it was enough to,
you know, enough to
say,
scare
it's going to be terrible. The sky's going to fall. It's all going to go to hell.
Yeah.
And I think, Katie, if we really are serious about breaking up monopoly power, breaking up corporate power, the multinational corporations who search the world for the cheapest of everything to sell in the highest consuming markets, we have got to pull out of the WTO. The WTO has no darn business telling us whether or not we can label beef or pork in this country. They have no business. Get rid of the WTO, withdraw from it. And I know you can't talk about that with Congress being supportive of this globalization stuff. And I talk about globalization from the corporate power point of view. You know, I'm happy to be friendly with my neighbors around the world and have commerce and trade between individuals in all different kinds of countries and where it's mutually beneficial. But under the WTO, it's only exploitive. It only concentrates wealth into the hands of a few big corporations, and we have to stop that. So, but we're not going to get cool back unless Congress steps in and gets a backbone and says, look, we're going to have country of origin labeling, just like Canada has. Canada complains about country of origin labeling, yet they've got it, and we can't have it because they want to be able to ship their cattle and meat into the United States, which is their biggest market.
Yeah.
And so it's amazing how much more power Canada has over our own Congress than we have as citizens of the United States.
That is an interesting point you draw. So when they talk about transparency and labeling, if it's not cool, what is it?
Well, I think we're going back to the piece about that imported meat coming in as imported foreign product. And when upon repackaging, it gets the product of the USA label. So that's different than cool. It's not necessarily going to come in and say this meat is from Canada. but it can't come in and say, this is a product of the USA. But hey, it's not just meat. If you're a hothouse tomato grower in Canada shipping product into Colorado during the winter, it gets the Colorado grown label put on it.
No way.
Or Colorado Proud label put on it. Or it can get product of the USA upon repackaging. So it's not just in the meat that that's occurring. And that's something that USDA can fix right now. So I'm confident that this executive order will at least impact that and do it fairly soon. And the other reason I'm more confident and I'm happier now than I was during the Obama days is because we have some friends. We have some friends that have been appointed into USDA positions of importance. Andy Green as an advisor to Secretary Vilsack is just a good friend, a longtime friend, and he gets it. I mean, he totally understands what needs to be done. You can see his work in this executive order. Tim Wu in the West Wing is amazing. Tim Wu is all over monopoly power. He knows how much it threatens our freedom and our liberty as individuals, as citizens of this country. And he's got a seat at the table of leadership. So Tim Wu's going to be really important to us. And of course, the other one that's amazing is Lena Khan as the chair of the Federal Trade Commission. The Federal Trade Commission is still stacked with folks who represent Wall Street interests over the interests of citizens. But still, I think we can start moving things now. So we have Lena Khan and Rohit Chopra, both on the Federal Trade Commission, that are very strong anti-monopoly type law enforcers.
Right.
And so from that perspective, I'm excited. But I am not a bit excited about Congress. I'm sick of Congress. I mean, like right now, we're talking about the filibuster. We can't do anything unless we kick out the filibuster. And you know, we need another election cycle, you know, which is, you know, a year and a half out. And of course, you risk losing some seats, perhaps. And I don't care if it's Republican or Democrat. We need legislators that are on the side of U.S. citizens, on the side of democracy, on the side of freedom and liberty. We just don't have it. And the Democrats have been absolutely every bit as bad as far as monopoly power and control of Wall Street as any of the Republicans are. You know, it doesn't matter which party it is. They're both controlled by the big money. But I'm at least more optimistic now. I'm not ready to celebrate.
I found that whole product labeling thing a little bit confusing, and I was especially surprised by the quote in AgWeb Daily, where the NCBA, legal counsel guy, is praising the administration for addressing product of USA labeling. But now I'm beginning to understand it. I mean, thanks to you.
And just one more point on that. Basically, what they're saying is you can't lie about where the meat comes from.
Right.
But you can't tell them where it came from either. See what I'm saying?
And that's why the NCBA likes it. Because they were very much against COOL as well, country of origin labeling. Am I right? I
mean, that's exactly right. NCBA has been against everything that was of interest to the independent cattle producer.
That's right. Oh, and just for people who don't know, NCBA is the National Cattlemen's Beef Association, which is a very powerful, probably the most powerful lobbying group on behalf of beef production in the United States. And they spend, you know, hundreds of, I won't estimate how much money they spend lobbying, but trust me, they throw a lot of money at Congress.
So, well, they've got our beef checkoff.
They've got your checkoff dollars, right.
When the National Cattlemen's became the National Cattlemen's Beef Association. It was a result of the National Cattlemen's merging with the checkoff.
Right.
And so basically there's an $80 million a year checkoff that comes from independent cattle producers. Anyone who sells a beef animal has to pay into it. And NCBA was able to capture that fund, and they have used it to lobby Congress and became extremely powerful. And as a result, they represent meatpacker interests and big retailer interests too.
Right.
Way over the
interest of actual farmers and ranchers. So
that's right. It's just a travesty.
Yeah.
We're going to take a very short break here for a sponsor drop, and we'll be right back with Mike Calicrate to talk a little bit more about the executive order issued by the Biden administration on July 8th. So please stay tuned for that.
Hey, this is Hannah, HRN's program manager. You may have noticed that we have a whole new look. We also launched a new website that's going to make your listening easier and more enjoyable than ever before. HRN is the original food podcast network. And as we enter a new chapter in our 12-year history, I want to ask you to invest in HRN for the long haul. If you rely on this show to fuel your food media diet, become a monthly sustaining member today. Our members keep the voice of America's food movement alive and kicking. Your donations support this podcast along with 40 other shows on Heritage Radio Network. Your contribution helps give HRN the security we need to stay on the airwaves throughout the pandemic. And your continued support is allowing us to reopen our studio. Plus, we like to give our regular members special treatment. So sign up to become a monthly donor and get access to our secret menu. We've gathered together exclusive discounts and offers from some of your favorite food and beverage brands. So you get to enjoy insider pricing on goods that will ship right to your door. Join our community of monthly donors, and special deals will come your way throughout the summer. So, can you make a gift of $5 or $10 a month? It'll show me and our whole team at HRN how much this podcast and food radio in general means to you. Become a monthly sustaining member today at heritageradionetwork.org/donate.
Okay. So now here's the next thing I wanted to talk about. What did you think about this? The Agriculture Department is supposed to institute, quote, measures to enhance price discovery, increase transparency, and improve the functioning of the cattle and other livestock markets. So I want to know what those measures are going to be and how will they be enforced, especially given what we've seen over the last 10 years in terms of these massive price-fixing, you know, schemes that have been across the board in every sector of the animal agricultural, you know, industrial playing field.
Yeah, we can talk. Yeah, I got that. Yeah, they can. Transparency would be something easy that they could fix without an act of
without Congress.
That's right.
So what would
again?
Those...
You go back to rulemaking, Katie.
Uh-huh.
See, we passed the mandatory price reporting, which would have given us transparency.
Right.
So there wouldn't be any secret deals. There wouldn't be any sweetheart stuff going on and to get their captive supplies. And the whole world would know what Paul Engler with Cactus Feeders is getting for preference.
Right.
That would have killed it. That would have killed all of that. And just shining the light on it is a big deal. Well, during rulemaking, the big meat packers were able, and the big feeders too, they were able to get the confidentiality thing added.
Right.
Well, that was simple rulemaking. That can change. We can change that right away.
And is that something that Vilsack can do himself without having to consult with Congress?
Absolutely. He can call for another rulemaking session
right
on that mandatory price reporting. In fact, it's up for renewal this fall.
So
we've got a great opportunity to rewrite that the rules.
I sure hope that happens. But Mike, so how will they enforce it? Like what? You know, what measures can they take to make sure that people are, in fact, transparent with their pricing?
Well, then it's just a matter of USDA using their authority to investigate.
You
know, if you're killing, you know, 600,000 cattle a week, you better get the prices on those numbers of cattle.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what was the deal? What were those prices paid
right.
for that number of animals? Right now, it's, you know, you got captive supplies that are, you know, 80% or more. And, you know, none of that gets reported. None of that stuff gets, none of those prices.
None of those prices are reported. Yeah.
Right.
So give me an idea of like, how will that change things for people like you?
you know, like what will that mean to you in terms of dollars and cents? I mean, are you going to be able to?
Well, it's going to. Well, part of the real problem we have here is we only have four meat packers. And so until you break them up, and I think you've got to really turn them into public utilities, and government has to run them probably, or you've got to really crank down on them and limit them to certain margins. You know, you're just not going to see much competition. And they've already delegated and designated their territories, and so it's going to be really hard for the government to go and, you know, start getting them to buy in all these feedlots again. You know, I remember when Bruce Bass was asked the question about his cash, you know, his cattle buyers that would go out and visit the feedlots. He says, well, we're not going to need them in the future. We'll just sort of, you know, reduce that number as they die off. He said, he used the word attrition. He says they will be eliminated by attrition. We won't necessarily go in and just fire those guys because they've been with us a long time. And you know, we could still use them some, at least go out and look at cattle, you know, that we're going to have on the formula. But he said, we're not going to add any more. And so they don't even really have cattle buyers anymore that are capable of going out.
Right. I mean, that's the thing. It's like that whole sort of section. I mean, not that I pretend to any expertise in this, but it seems to me that it has just essentially been dismantled. And that the way I understand it is that a producer goes to one of the big packers and says, you know, I want to bring my animals in on such and such a date. What price will you give me? And they don't really find out, and correct me again if I'm wrong, they don't really find out literally until they get those animals to the gates of that packing house.
Oh, they don't even know then. They don't really know until that animal is hung on a rail and they've got the weight and the grade and all of the other things that price is based upon.
That would be changed if this rule were, you know, say altered to the degree that you would like to see it, and then plus the enforcement came in along with it. Then you would see a revival of the cattle buyers who are going out and saying, "Hey, I really like that guy's cattle. This one, not so much." And then it's like it is true competition again, right?
Yeah, that's right. And really, you know, whether or not we have an increase in the number of cattle buyers or not, sort of back before 1996. Work, the Western Organization and Resource Council, a very smart bunch of folks out of Montana, came up with this work rule. And basically their model would be that all animals, whether contracted or otherwise cash traded, would be bought and sold in an open and competitive market. And you could make it an electronic market. And so everybody could see everything. And if you were looking for Black Angus cattle that would all grade high choice or whatever, I mean, you could have your standards, your set of attributes that you were after, but everybody would have the ability to supply animals with those attributes, not just your buddies, you know, that have got a sweetheart special captive supply deal.
Right.
But honestly, that tool, if put in place right now, would fix all this stuff.
Amazing.
But because it would, it's going to be opposed very aggressively.
Yeah. Of course it is. Oh my God. This is going to, you know, they're actually going to have to pay real prices. I mean, they're going to have to pay real, you know, competitive prices for, you know, for product. They're not going to be able to say, well, today I feel like paying 32 cents a pound. So that's what you're going to get, pal, because if you don't like that, you can take your 2,000 head of cattle and head right on back to your ranch and see what you do with those cows. I mean, you know, it's just unbelievable. Because, I mean, for people who aren't really familiar, like cattle have to be, all animals have to get to the packing plant at a certain weight. Otherwise, if they're too big, you can't sell them for their premium price, like say for steaks and chops or whatever. They have to be a certain size, which is what the consumer or, you know, the grocery manufacturer, whatever it is, has determined is the optimum size. And once you get out past that, it's like oysters. Like last year in Rhode Island, we grow a lot of oysters here. People didn't buy the oysters. All the institutional buyers went down because of COVID. So these guys are stuck with literally millions of oysters that are way too big for the market. And so they lose their whole, you know, vig on that. And it's kind of the same thing in livestock, right? Yeah.
Yeah. And Katie, what you just described, no individual would ever get away with treating another person that way.
Yeah, right.
But corporations can. And yeah. that's the problem, is these corporations have become bigger than our government.
Yeah.
And so they can extract as much wealth as they want without any pushback.
Right.
And of course, these settlements, these ridiculous settlements for wage fixing and pork, price fixing.
Price fixing and poultry and pork, yeah, absolutely.
All that, they just walk away laughing. It's a simple, low cost of doing business. Yeah. We aren't getting anything done here. And so until we can get Congress to act and say this is what we want, we want open and competitive markets. We want small business to do well again, mm-hmm. and give the individual a chance to prosper again. Right now, there is no hope of getting in the meatpacking business when you've got predators like the Big Four that we have today. And one of the things that really concerns me right now, when we are celebrating some of these new slaughterhouses that are being proposed, mm-hmm. Like the 1500 head a day or whatever, the one in North Platte, Nebraska, there's one they're planning for Iowa. And what these really are is mini versions of the big plants that have done so much damage. They're mini versions. And the question has to be, okay, assuming you're going to do everything the big meat packers doing, like buying cattle below cost of production, exploiting refugee workers, mm-hmm. Abusing animals.
Poor animal welfare, right?
I mean, everything the big meat packers are doing wrong, these new plants are going to have to do as well in order to compete.
Yes,
but
that's
what
true.
They will not have is access to the big retail market or the food service market, because the big packers are not going to let them in. And so my answer is, much, much smaller local regional plants. Maybe instead of 100,000 or 2,000 head a day plants, put in 1,000, 10 or 20 head a day plants, mm-hmm. and put them in communities all across the country, and they're privately owned or they're cooperatively owned perhaps, but connected directly to consumers. Absolutely no connection to the existing big four retail firms that control retail prices. The ones that have jacked consumers. In cooperation with the big meat packers, they have price gouged consumers.
Oh, yeah.
And of course, when I explain how the food system is so broken and how we've price gouged consumers, whenever you tell that to somebody, it doesn't matter really what business they're in. They'll say, oh, well, yeah, that happened in lumber, or that happened in, in the internet. That happened over here with whatever industry they're involved with.
Sure.
What industry isn't overly concentrated today and serving corporate profits over the interests of people?
Well, that's why this executive order was such a big deal, because it really did cover all of the major industries.
Yeah.
It had a big section on agriculture, but it was also aviation. It was, pharmaceuticals. I mean, it was really like, wow, it was very ambitious. But we're going to have to wrap it up in a couple of minutes. But I just wanted to see, how you felt about some of the, do you feel like some of these issues that really have defined the last 30 years in terms of consolidation and competition, do you feel like this executive order has included or gone far enough? Do you think it will make changes in the industry that you would like to see, or are we going to get hung up on that consider changing the rules problem that we talked about earlier?
well, Katie, I could not have written a better executive order.
Good.
For the industry that I'm in. And that's the cattle and meat industry. I couldn't have written a better one. I would have preferred, to eliminate the word consider, but I understand where we're at with Congress.
Sure.
And anyone who flies on an airplane is going to love this executive order. I just don't think it could have been better considering our situation. And as far as whether or not we actually get it done is going to probably be dependent upon the next election, to see how many new people we can get into Congress that are willing to really step up, like Senator Tester Montana.
He's a good guy. Yeah.
And yeah, boy, is he ever a good one. And we've got, you know, Senator Lee out of Utah, who's very supportive of this stuff. Senator Booker, you know, Klobuchar just wrote the book on antitrust.
Well, and, Booker has proposed that whole new thing about, you know, a moratorium on CAFOs. And, oh, my God, the trades. And I know you read them, too, Mike. But the trades went crazy over that.
Yeah, I loved it. I loved it. Yeah.
Hilarious.
Yeah. I'll tell you, Senator Booker is doing his job, and he's fantastic. He's been a real supporter of the independent cattle producer and trying to rebuild agriculture in general. But we've got some really good leadership in Congress now. Senator Warren hates monopolies.
Yep.
Of course, Bernie Sanders hates monopolies. You know, look, if you hate monopolies, you need to be elected. If you love monopolies, kick them out.
Yeah, that's pretty much how I feel about it as well. Listen, we're going to have to say goodbye for now, but thank you so, so much, Mike. This has been a great conversation. I've enjoyed every minute. I learned a lot. So I hope we keep on talking. I'll be in touch the next time I see, or if you find something you want to talk about, just call me.
All right, Katie. Thanks for this opportunity. I really appreciate it.
Oh, it was a pleasure. And we'll see you next week, folks. Thanks a lot for tuning in. Bye-bye for now.
What Doesn't Kill You is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
Hi, listeners. We want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway, and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Aweli, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries. Like, why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode? Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, a French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.